say sit back. Yeah. And my other boys don't know how to act. Yeah. This is the Bill Kelly Show. You're on 900 CHML. You're watching on Cable 14. Brought to you by the Morris Law Group. When you hire the Morris Law Group, you're going to have access to a team of experienced personal injury lawyers who will ensure that you're fairly compensated for injuries and loss. Get the Morris Edge today. Call 905-526-8080. You recognize this as Justin Timberlake? If you don't, then you're not monitoring what your kids are listening to. Sexy Back is actually one of the more tame pieces of music that a lot of kids may have on their iPods these days. Well, for that matter, a lot of young adults, too. It's a popular tune. But there are some others that are a little more suggestive. Some would suggest downright lewd when it comes to some of the lyrics in some of the music that our kids are listening to these days. And we're going to open that discussion up and that debate up because I know that's something that parents are very concerned about, and justifiably so, too. There's a new study now that finds that high exposure to lyrics that describe degrading sex is associated with some high levels of sexual behavior in teens. This was done at the University of Pittsburgh, and the lead author of the study, Dr. Brian Primack, joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to talk about this. Dr. Primack, thank you so much for the time today.
Thanks for having me.
A fascinating study for parents like myself and so many others of our listeners who are very concerned about what's happening with our kids right now. I guess first and foremost, maybe a bit of a definition of exactly what you did for the study itself, because you pretty much divided the kids into those who don't listen a whole lot and those who listen a great deal.
That's right. We used a pretty comprehensive content analysis as well as student self-reports to categorize kids into three different categories. Those who heard were exposed to the most degrading sex in popular music, a middle group, and then the least degrading sex in popular music. And the ones who were exposed to the most were more than twice as likely to have had early risky sexual behavior.
Interesting, which opens up the debate as to whether or not it's the lyrics and the music that's actually moving them in that direction, or whether they were moving in that direction and the music is the sort of thing that they like to listen to. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing, isn't it, Doctor?
It is, absolutely. And no one study can really, you know, tell you definitely what came first. We certainly endeavored to control for that statistically, but still, I think that that's a really important consideration, and that we can really just say from this study, as well as many others in this area, that it's just an association.
Doctor, let me ask you something that's maybe just a little bit outside of the parameters of the study, but obviously with your expertise in the field, you may want to comment on this. Do parents actually understand what's happening with teenagers? I mean, I can remember having a discussion not too many months ago on this program when we revealed the fact that, for instance, the first age of sexual contact for many kids today is around 13 or 14, and some parents were just astounded to hear that. No, not our kid. Well, you know, it's somebody's kid because the statistics are there.
I agree with you that we do often have blinders on when it comes to factoids like that one, when it comes to exposure. We found, for example, on average, that the average student in our study was exposed to 15 hours a week of sexual degrading portrayals in music, and I don't think that a lot of parents are aware.
Well, the fact of the matter is if they're listening to an iPod or an MP3 player, whatever the case might be, whatever the technology is that they use, I mean, it's this little thing that's sitting in their pocket. They've got earphones on. I mean, unless parents actually go out of their way to make sure that they know what's going on, there's no way that they could.
I agree. There really is unprecedented access today, and also the way it used to be that to listen to your favorite song, you had to just sort of wait around until it came on the radio. Well, now you can listen over and over and over again in the privacy of your iPod, and even often in schools. There are kids who just sort of keep an earbud in all day.
Well, you know, go to any bus stop right outside of a high school and try to find two or three kids that don't have earphones on. I mean, it's the way that they entertain themselves these days.
Yes.
What kind of an impact, Doctor? I understand that you can't make broad-based statements. We've already discussed that. But what kind of an impact does the music have?
Well, you know, like you just said, we can't really make any major statements, you know, but what we do at least find in this study is that the the risk associated with this kind of exposure is as high as a lot of the risks associated with other exposures that we consider to be, you know, very important predictors, like parental monitoring, like sensation-seeking tendency and rebellious tendency and stuff like that. So at the very least, we can say that they might be somehow linked. And although, you know, we certainly are not in favor of, you know, just blanketly trying to get rid of certain kinds of music because that would be, you know, akin to censorship. We do believe that it would be valuable for people to be aware of this association and also to try to increase the education that we do around it, something we call media literacy, where you give young people the tools to analyze and evaluate these things that they are exposed to every day so that it's more of an empowering solution and less of a protectionist one.
Now, you brought up the idea of censorship, which may be the initial reaction by some parents who are simply going to say, well, if it has that kind of an impact on our kids, we should just ban it altogether. But your study suggests that's not really the way to go here.
Well, there certainly can be arguments made for attempts to limit a number of things. But at the same time, I guess we've learned that those kinds of solutions sometimes are not very feasible and, you know, in a free society aren't necessarily advisable either.
Here's a question that I think an awful lot of parents have an awful lot of trouble wrestling with. Is the suggestive lyrics, and I'm not going to repeat some of them. I mean, I know that in the overview I've seen of your study here, you do quote a few of those, and I don't necessarily think we have to get into the details of these, but I think, you know, the implications are there as to what these are. They're very suggestive sexually. Some of them talk about domination. Some of them talk about physical violence with one gender over another, usually male over female. I guess the question we ask is does the average 13 or 14 or 15-year-old have the wherewithal? Are they developed enough, from a physiological standpoint, to be able to interpret that that's art, that's not reality, or do they get the two intertwined?
I think that there are a lot of educational gaps in this area. People often have the developmental ability to understand these lyrics. However, they don't necessarily have the developmental ability to understand, you know, what is real life and what is not. Something to you or I who've been around a little bit longer, you know, we might realize that this portrayal does not represent the way sexual experience normally goes. However, a young person often just incorporates that into their worldview, and that can change their social norms. It can change their attitudes.
In the absence of any contrary points of view. In other words, if they don't have discussions with their parents or anybody else about sexual attitudes or about the way that one gender should treat another, they're going to use this as the barometer. Then
I agree. Yes.
So obviously it can have a factor. I mean, if you've got a 14 or 15 year old boy, for instance, who hears these sorts of songs, that could fashion his view as to how he should treat women.
That's right. The theory, social cognitive theory, says that these become sort of scripts in somebody's subconscious, and they say, oh, this is just the way I'm supposed to behave. And then females as well, you know, sort of get this script in the back of their mind that, you know, this is okay for me to do in this way because, you know, it's represented in a song. What's very interesting about the study was that we did find this relationship that we've been talking about with regard to degrading sexual portrayals and sexual experience, but we did not find the same relationship between non-degrading sexual portrayals and sexual behavior. And what that means is that the context is important, in that it's not just any time you hear sex that might influence sexual behavior. It is, you know, particular types of sexual portrayal, and I think that's something we need to look into further.
The sensationalism, the titillation, then, seems to be an accelerant?
Yeah, well, we defined degrading sexual portrayals, as others have in the past, really with two major criteria. One was that it had to be completely physical without, you know, any, for example, emotional component. The second was that there had to be some difference in power, you know, one, as you were mentioning before, you know, very dominant individual. And so the bottom line is it seems like these are the more concerning types of portrayals. Unfortunately, they're extremely common. In fact, we did a study last year that showed that around two-thirds of all sexual portrayals are degrading in nature, according to this definition.
Well, it's something we have to pay attention to. It's a very enlightening study, Doctor. Thank you so much for the time this morning. It's greatly appreciated.
And thank you very much for having me.
Take care.